Welcome to the deep dive. Our mission is pretty straightforward. We take rich, sometimes complex source material, and we try to pull out the core insights for you.
That's right.
Today, we're diving deep into a passage that's just foundational for understanding covenant theology. It's Genesis 17, verses 10 through 15.
Yeah, a really pivotal section.
And this isn't just about reading some ancient rules. It's like looking at a piece of stunning linguistic architecture. Theology gets built right into identity, into flesh.
Exactly. And when you look at the Hebrew original, you realize just how much work the language itself is doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's way beyond what you typically get in translation.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal today is really to unpack that linguistic intensity, see how the deliberate word choices, the connections between verbs and nouns, make this covenant feel so concrete, so permanent, and universal too.
Focusing on cutting and renaming.
Absolutely. Those two concepts are key.
Okay, so here's the aha moment for you listening. If you've read this before, but maybe only in English, you might have missed this incredible literary symphony that's happening underneath.
It's true.
The whole theological weight of this covenant really hinges on specific Hebrew roots that are cleverly linked together. We're going to slow down, listen to the language, and show you why this idea of cutting becomes just unforgettable once you see its triple layer of meaning here.
Let's get into it.
All right. Segment one, the covenant cut. This physical sign, let's start there. We see this shift, right? Before, covenants were often ratified externally, divine appearances, ceremonies.
Right, like rituals.
But here, verse 10, suddenly it's visceral. It's physical. This is my covenant. Every male among you shall be circumcised. It feels like it moves from an external promise to something permanent marked inside the community on their bodies.
That permanence is absolutely crucial. But maybe before we jump right into circumcision itself, we need a bit of context. The Hebrew Bible, when it talks about making a covenant, it almost always uses a specific phrase, an idiom.
Ah, you mean karat berit.
Exactly. Karat berit.
Which literally means to cut a covenant.
Precisely. And we saw that enacted pretty dramatically back in Genesis 15, didn't we?
Yeah.
Abraham cuts animals in half. It's this symbolic oath, basically saying, you know, if I break this promise, may I become like these pieces.
Very graphic image.
It is. And
yeah,
that action, that karat, the cutting of the covenant, it was external. It was ceremonial.
Okay, so then we get to chapter 17. And the sources, they show this sign changing fundamentally. The command is himu lakim kol sakar. The verb for circumcision is mul. How does mul connect back to that core idea of karat, of cutting the covenant?
Well, this is what's so fascinating. The physical sign itself becomes, in a way, the fulfillment of that legal idiom. The root mul, it just means to cut around.
Simple enough.
Yeah, but by commanding mul, this physical cutting of the foreskin god is putting a permanent mark on Abraham's descendants. So the sources are basically telling us the covenant, which used to be signified by karat, by cutting animals, is now transferred. It's inscribed permanently onto the very flesh of Abraham's people. The covenant sign is the continuation of that covenant cut.
Wow. That linguistic link just binds the theology and the physical practice together perfectly. And verse 11 calls this mark the rock audit, the sign of the covenant.
Yes, the sign, a symbol. Now, we do have an earlier example of an odd, don't we? The rainbow, the sign God gave to Noah.
Mm-hmm.
And comparing those two signs, it really highlights the difference between those covenants. The rainbow, well, it's distant, isn't it? It's a sign up in the sky. You see it after a storm. It's a promise to the whole world, but you observe it from afar.
But circumcision is the complete opposite. It's immediate. It's intensely personal.
Absolutely. It's carried by the individual, on the individual. It's not distant at all. It's unavoidable. It's an initiation sign, a constant, physically undeniable marker of identity. It defines who belongs to this covenant community right from birth.
So it's a sign that travels with you.
Exactly. Constantly reminding you, and maybe just as importantly, reminding others of your place in this promise.
Okay, so we've established the what of the sign. Let's shift to the logistics, because the timing and the scope here are also incredibly specific, and they really expand the commitment, don't they?
They really do.
Let's start with the timing. Why so specific? 8 days old.
Yeah, verse 12 is very precise. Every male 8 days old shall be circumcised. The Hebrew is Ben Shimon et Yamin, literally a son of 8 days. And that timing, well, it's deeply significant, not just maybe medically, but theologically. The number 8 in Scripture, it often points to a new beginning, doesn't it? Or starting a new cycle.
Right, because 7 completes the week, the creation cycle. So 8 kicks off something new.
Exactly that. The child completes that first natural cycle of life, the week, and then bam, on the eighth day, they're immediately initiated into this new pattern, this spiritual covenantal pattern. It marks a transition, really, from just natural life to a life defined by the covenant. It reinforces this idea that it's an eternal pattern, something that transcends the everyday.
And the scope, the inclusiveness, that feels pretty radical too, especially for the ancient world. Verse 13 insists it's not just for biological descendants, the ones born in your house.
No, not at all.
It's also for those bought with your money, servants, foreigners, outsiders who join the community.
Yes, and we really can't overstate this point. The covenant sign goes beyond biology, beyond heritage. If you're part of Abraham's household, his oikos, his community, it doesn't matter where you came from originally. You must bear the mark.
So it makes the community definition about belief and belonging, not just bloodline.
Precisely. It's ideological, religious, not just genetic. The covenant is creating this potentially global, open community right from the start, right there in Abraham's camp.
And just to make sure everyone gets how serious this is, the language itself really doubles down.
It does, yeah. Look at the grammar in verse 13. The command uses a doubled verb, himoyimel. That's an emphatic form in Hebrew. It means something like cut. Yes, cut. Or maybe you must absolutely be circumcised.
No wiggle room.
Zero ambiguity. No space left for, you know, deciding later. It's absolute.
And this leads right into how God defines the covenant itself. He calls it Berit Olam, an everlasting covenant.
Mm-hmm. And that word Olam, it's critical. We often translate it forever, but sometimes that English word feels a bit passive, maybe.
Okay.
Olam carries this sense of age spanning or beyond the immediate horizon. It's less about just endless time ticking by and more about a commitment that survives through all the ups and downs of history, through different ages.
Ah.
It guarantees that no matter what happens in one generation, you know, war, migration, people failing, the core covenant identity is meant to stretch into the next age and the age after that and never expires. That physical sign is meant to identify Abraham's line across all the historical epochs yet to come.
So we have the sign, the timing, the scope, the permanence. But covenants aren't just about promises. They involve obligations, serious ones.
Absolutely.
If the command to receive the cut is so emphatic, what happens if someone refuses? What are the stakes for not bearing that mark?
Okay, and this is where the Hebrew wordplay just delivers this rhetorical knockout blow. It's quite intense. Verse 14 spells out the consequence. The uncircumcised male, he shall be cut off from his people.
Cut off. So refusing the cut means you get cut off. That sounds like it can't be a coincidence.
Oh, it's entirely deliberate. We're actually dealing with two different Hebrew roots here, but they're used in parallel to create this really stark contrast and intensity. So the uncircumcised male, the Arul Zalkar, the one who didn't submit to the cut, mole,
right.
He faces the consequence, which is expressed by the verb wanikita.
Wanikita, to be cut off. Now, surely that verb must be related to the original covenant-cutting verb, kadat.
It is, absolutely. Nikrat is essentially the passive or consequence form of kadat. Think about it like this.
Okay.
Making the covenant involve the action kadat, to cut or ratify.
Mm-hmm.
Identifying with that covenant involves the action mole, to be cut around, circumcised.
Got it.
Refusing mole results in the state of Nikrat being cut off. Excellent.
Yeah. Wow. So the penalty isn't just like being kicked out. It's a direct inversion of the core ritual. By refusing that small physical cut that links him to the covenant.
Yeah.
The individual receives this huge existential cut that severs him completely from the covenant people.
That's the theological genius built right into the grammar. The language itself is telling us, refuse the covenant cut and you get dismembered, surgically removed from the people who share that promise. Your fate is defined by the very act you rejected.
That's incredibly powerful.
It's a stark warning. Participation isn't optional if you want to stay within the blessing and the promise of that Berit Olam, that age-spanning covenant.
Okay, so the physical marking, the consequences. But there's one more transformation here. The covenant started with Abram becoming Abraham earlier in the chapter. His name changed.
Right, a huge identity shift.
And now in the final verse we're looking at, verse 15, the focus shifts from Abraham's body to Sarai's name. It completes the transformation of this foundational couple.
Yes, and this shift really shows how comprehensive the covenant is. It demands transformation in, well, in flesh, in future destiny, and in core identity for both parents of this promised nation. Sarai, whose name was Shera, becomes Sarah, Shera.
Now, both names basically mean princess or noblewoman, right?
They do, fundamentally.
So if the core meaning is pretty much the same, what's the crucial linguistic difference? What signals the covenant's new, broader scope through her name change?
This is a beautiful detail, often highlighted by Jewish commentators. The key difference is in the ending, the suffix. So Rai Shari, that ending I is often seen as a possessive form, like my, suggesting my princess.
Meaning she was noble, but primarily within Abram's context. His household, his sphere.
Exactly. My princess, sort of limited to his immediate world. But then God changes it. He drops that possessive suffix. She becomes simply Sarah, Shura, which means princess, full stop, or sometimes even translated queen mother.
Ah, so it universalizes her role.
Precisely. The name change expands her destiny, her authority. She goes from being my princess, tied to one household, to being the princess, this royal mother figure, whose influence now stretches to encompass those multitudes and nations that God just promised through Abraham.
Okay.
Her identity is now defined by the future scope of the covenant, not just her present limited situation.
That really makes the covenant feel holistic. It's not just a command for a physical mark on the male descendants. It literally rewrites their names, their core identities, establishing the future scale and destiny right there. Both Abraham and Sarah are transformed to fit the sides of the promise.
Mm. Yeah, when you pull it all together, the mastery of the Hebrew in this passage is just undeniable. God is writing this covenant into like four dimensions all at once.
Four dimensions. Okay, break that down.
First, it's in the flesh, right? Marked physically by mole.
Got it.
Second, it's in memory and pattern, established for that deliberate eight-day cycle.
Okay, memory.
Third, it's projected into the future, defined by that term, Beret Olam, the age-spanning nature.
Right, future.
And fourth, maybe most profoundly, it's embedded in identity through the literal status-changing renaming of Sarai and Sarah, mirroring Abraham's own change. Flesh, memory, future, identity, all reshaped.
The power of it is, well, the promise is so huge, so age-spanning, as you put it, that God literally had to restructure their existence, change their bodies, change their names, just so they could contain the destiny he was giving them.
Yeah.
They were given, essentially, new vocabulary to even understand who they had just become.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, it raises a really interesting question for you, the listener, as you think about this material.
Okay, what's the final thought for today?
Well, if God embedded the foundational promises for this community right into the core vocabulary, the roots, the idioms of the language itself, what foundational ideas or commitments may be hidden in the words we use every day without thinking, define and shape your community or your identity now?
That's something to reflect on. What's the silent power of the words you live by?
Exactly.
Something to mull over. Thanks for diving deep with us today.